Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dory, the communications manager here at the Denver Audubon. We're an independent, nonprofit chapter of the National Audubon Society, and we believe that birds are not just beautiful, they're vital. They're messengers of ecosystem health, and when we protect them, we also nurture the well-being of our communities, the environment, and the planet. This podcast, The Curious Bird, is part of a larger effort to uplift what we call a voice of the sky, a growing community of people like you who feel called to speak up, act boldly, and care deeply for the future of Earth and all her wild beings. Our goal is to share the stories of inspired advocates and to reflect on the creativity, interconnectedness, and wonder that the natural world awakens in us. We hope these stories spark lifelong learning, deepen your sense of stewardship, and remind us all of the power of collective care. So, wherever and whenever you're tuning in from, thank you. We're so glad you're here. Let's take flight together and dive into today's episode of The Curious Bird. I am so excited to have Meredith McBurney here with me today, who is the bander and volunteer coordinator with Bird Conservancy of the Rockies. And I have to say, when I started at the Denver Audubon, I heard your name a lot. And so there was a bit of this elusive quality. There was always Meredith, and it was attached to a word like is awesome, wonderful, so cool. So I just couldn't wait to meet Meredith. And so I'm going to give just a little bit of a backstory that I think is pretty fun on how we met. And so I went to my first bird banding in May of this year, which is 2025. And I show up early. It's a misty morning. I head to the banding station and I see one of the volunteers I had just met actually at Hawkwatch, and then Dr. Garth Spellman of Denver Museum of Nature and Science. And so it's early. It's before the public arrives. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to walk down to the river. So I'm walking down to the river and I hear these footsteps shuffling through the dirt behind me. And I hear Dory, and it's Dr. Spellman. And so we just start chatting life and birds, and we'll, of course, in this episode talk a lot about bird banding. But so we turn left and arrive at one of the mist nets, which are a part of the bird banding process. And in the mist nets, there are three birds. And Dr. Spellman so tenderly and gently untangles them and puts them in these small bags. And he says, okay, can you take these over to the bird banding station? So I've never done bird banding before, and now I have three bags of birds in my hand. I'm like, okay, like this is very serious. Like, I'm taking this responsibility so seriously. And so I start making my way right back to the banding station, come around the corner and collide almost with this woman. And I look and her name tag says Meredith. And in my head, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is Meredith. I've got three birds in my hands. And Meredith looks at me like, who are you? And so that is how Meredith McBurney and I met, and it was wonderful. And my first day bird banding was pretty much a crash course. So thank you, Meredith, for being here. How are you today?
I'm good. Not banding today.
Not banding today.
Able to focus on other things.
Yeah. How does that feel?
You know, I'm excited for fall to come because I'm looking forward to getting back out. But the situation you describe is those of us who are either working because we work for Bird Conservancy, or the large number of volunteers who are absolutely dedicated to everything that happens at the banding station, are focused on one thing and one thing only, which is to get the birds out of the net, get them analyzed, and get them released safely. And that's what's going on. We're moving things along as fast as we can and as safely as we can. Mm-hmm. And we kind of don't care which human has the bird at that moment.
Yeah.
The bird in the bag, I know where these bags go.
Yep.
There you have it.
I just got to describe the bags too. They're just these little cotton bags with like teddy bears on them and spiral designs. And it's just, the experience is wonderful.
Our bag makers have a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
And spend a lot of time at the fabric stores picking out remnants.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And so there's people that volunteer and make these bags?
The volunteer who's made most of them, partly because she's been around so long, started volunteering before I came to Bird Conservancy, which was in 1998. Mm-hmm. And she's been making bags for forever. Wow. And she still does. Yeah. She also volunteers one day a week in the fall. So
that's amazing. I love just seeing the deeper and deeper I get into this work, how many people devote their time to the birds and to wildlife and the environment.
It's great that a lot of people are committed to birds.
Speaking of someone committed to birds, I'm going to read your bio to introduce you even more to everyone. So here we go. Meredith made her decision to make birds and their habitats her second career in 1997 when she held a warbler in the hand for the first time while volunteering for Earthwatch in Monteverde, Costa Rica. Returning to Colorado, she took Hugh and Erling Kingery's beginning birder class, obtained a bachelor's degree in zoology from Colorado State University, and learned banding skills from the many excellent banders who preceded her as the bander at Bar Lake Station. She has worked for the Bird Conservancy since 2004 and bands in the spring at Chatfield and the fall at Bar Lake. She loves the hands-on experience of banding, and she loves sharing that experience with the hundreds of kids and adults who visit the banding station every year. And so I read in an article by the Denverite, you were quoted as saying, mm-hmm. I was 50. I didn't know a house finch from a flicker. Somebody put a black and white warbler in my hand, and that was it. I didn't want to go home. I was ready for a change. What was it about holding that black and white warbler that was so pivotal for you?
It's fair to say that I think every bander I've ever known has the equivalent of a spark bird, but it's the spark bird that makes them decide they want to band birds. And they remember that moment. That little black and white warbler, which is, you know, we're talking a few inches in size, and it weighs almost nothing. And it's so soft, and you have it in your hand, and you're petrified because it seems so fragile that you're going to do something wrong. And you let it go, and it flies away, and you say to yourself, why do I think that's fragile? Or isn't it amazing that something that light and delicate can be so tough and so strong? And had just, you know, the lead bander there was talking about how that bird had flown down from the United States and was going to winter in Costa Rica in that area because of where it can find food in the wintertime, and then it's going to fly back to North America. And I'm thinking, soft, fragile. It's just, anyway, it's an extraordinary sort of thing to have that experience. And sometimes people get so caught up in it, they never leave. That's me.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. And when I was there at the bird banding, I just saw on everyone's faces, and I felt it on my own, that awe of seeing a bird up close with all of that experience and feelings that you just described, and wonder and joy and gas of just exhilaration and enthusiasm. What is it like to be able to facilitate that experience for people?
Well, it's like you say,
yeah,
it's joyful. Every time it's gratifying. You had asked me earlier about experiences that I remember over time. And I thought, well, you know, it's every time anybody releases a bird. But years ago, we had a group from an assisted living program out. They came out in a van. They brought it. They didn't walk out. They brought the van out, and some of them were using walkers. And the aide, who had been a volunteer at the banding station, which is how this group got involved with us, told me that there was this one gentleman in the group who had, I think it's called like tunnel vision, where all he could see was what was right in front of him. And that if I was going to show him a bird, I needed to be careful to make sure I got in that tunnel. Yeah. So anyway, I was doing my usual thing, and I took this bird around, and I got to him, and he was paying attention, but I wasn't sure he was really completely in the messaging and the story and everything. I got it right in front of him into his sweet spot. And he went from an expression that was kind of, I'm here, okay, to, oh, he just gasped. And he said, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And he looked up at me, and, you know, it makes you tear up. Yeah. He was tearing up, and he looked down, and I put the bird in his hand, and the bird flew away. And the aide told me months afterwards that every time she saw him, he remembered her, and he remembered that bird. Mm. And it's like, this is, see, I can hardly talk about it even now.
Yeah, I'm tearing up right here, like you said. It's just... it's beautiful, and birds constantly remind me, whether it's my own experience with them or witnessing these experiences, how lucky we are to share a planet with them.
Yes.
To be here with these beautiful beings.
Absolutely.
And that joy, I would love to know in your words, why is that joy so important to keep passing on?
There are times when it's hard to find joy.
Yeah.
And this is one that's simple.
Mm.
That just seeing birds. I remember the first time I truly paid attention to a bird. I was in the Caribbean someplace after a scuba diving trip, and I'm sitting on the chair on the patio, you know, drinking a beer. And I look over, and a yellow and black bird has just perched on the railing. And I'm like, oh my God, this is pre-birding for me. And I'm like, wow, there are birds that look like that. And bird kind of tilts its head, does that, and flies away. And I'm like, wow. And it was like just that little moment. And birds can do that to anybody, anywhere, anytime.
I resonate with that. And the human experience is such a spectrum of feelings. Mm-hmm. And I have started putting feeders up in my own yard. And having the birds come visit, I have never been more excited to wake up in the mornings. Mornings have always been very difficult for me to get up. And I'm so excited to sit in the backyard and listen to them sing or just observe them flitting through the trees. And there was a day, maybe about a month ago, I was sitting in the shade of my tree in the backyard, and I was crying. I was having a really grief-soaked day about the state of the world. And I looked up into the tree. And I was like, oh my God, is that a... And it was a goldfinch.
Oh, great.
And it was the first time a goldfinch had come to the yard. And my crying turned from grief to joy. And the instantaneousness with which I could have grief and then be so profoundly filled with gratitude and joy and hope, I just felt this deep thank you to the birds and the earth. And it was everything in that moment. That bird changed my whole day, changed my whole life, because I'm still telling the story a month later, you know? And it's truly incredible. I feel so lucky.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I've taken this year, I took a section of my yard. I got a dog a few years ago, and he's very large and he's very active. And the grass sod doesn't do very well with big, active dogs.
Yes.
Besides that, I believe that we should be getting rid of as much of our sod, which really doesn't benefit anybody or anything. Mm-hmm. And we have to, you know, constantly put something on to keep the weeds away and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, the sod's gone, and I just let it go, and it has become a small area just totally overrun with sunflowers. And every morning I get up and open the windows and look outside to see how many goldfinch I can count on that are actually eating the seeds. And the birds have moved from the feeder over to, I mean, they're like, why would I eat this packaged stuff if I can have the real thing? And they've all moved over. House finches, black-capped chickadees, normal birds in my urban backyard. I've all moved over to the sunflowers, and sunflowers are moving like this, and the birds are holding on, eating. And I'm thinking, you know, this is really paradise.
It is. Yeah. Oh, yeah. A sunflower blowing in the wind with a goldfinch on it. Yeah. And we get to witness that. Yeah. It is paradise. So can you walk me through the bird banding process? And why is it such a critical conservation effort?
Well, you talked about the early step, which is to get birds caught in the net. Mm-hmm. They're made to be soft and movable so that the bird doesn't get hurt. Mm-hmm. And as you described, Garth taking out birds, that's what all of our people who are trained to extract birds do. Mm-hmm. They carefully get them out of the net, put them in the little bag, picking a bag that's not too big and not too small. It's a safe, easy way to carry the birds back to the banding station, and where we hang them on hooks, and they may wait a minute or two before we get to them. I mean, it actually calms them down. Mm-hmm. A lot of us had birds at home when we were kids, and you always put something over the cage at night to make it dark so that they wouldn't sing.
Yeah.
Trying to sleep. Well, that little soft bag makes the birds calm down. And our goal is to, in the 2, 3, 4 minutes that we have that bird, to learn as much as we can about it, to record the data, to mark it in some way so that if it gets caught again, we know exactly which one it was and that it matches up with a band, or take something off that will allow us to do additional research on that bird or that species, either a blood sample or feathers for DNA. To use that bird in that time frame to get as much information as possible about its life, its annual life cycle, which is what it does each year that it's alive, so that ultimately we can conserve birds. Birds are harder to conserve than some things. Mm. I mean, just the fact that they fly changes how you can track them. 70% of all birds have more than one home during the year, and those homes can be separated by hundreds, if not thousands, of miles. And we talk a lot about conservation at Bird Conservancy and Denver Audubon, but everything we do here, if that's all that is done for that bird or that species or the groups of birds that spend some of their year here, it isn't going to save the birds because they go someplace else. They either winter someplace else or they go someplace north to breed. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't got enough information about a species or a group of birds when it's starting to decline and you're trying to figure out what to do, you could make big mistakes. Yeah. You could think it was something here, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's where they go in Central America. So the things that we look at when we catch the bird, besides we put them on an aluminum band on every bird. Mm-hmm. It has a number, all distinct numbers. We measure the wing and the tail. We ID the bird, make sure we know exactly what species it is. To the extent we can, we confirm whether it's a male or a female. Most of these small songbirds, we can separate birds that hatched in the most recent year from older birds, which gives us an indication. The percent overall, the percentage of young versus old is important because you have to maintain a certain ratio or you start to realize that that species is declining. Mm-hmm. I mean, if all you have is adult birds, you know they didn't have a good breeding season.
Yeah.
If all you have is young birds, something is happening to the older population. And then you start to look at those factors as opposed to other things that you might look at if you're trying to conserve. We check for fat, which is an indication of health in a migrating bird. Mm-hmm. They can't migrate without fat on their body. It's their fuel source. We check to see if they're breeding. Mm. And we look for molt. All birds molt at least once a year. Some birds molt more often. And it's an indication of where they are in their cycle. So then we weigh them, and oftentimes in the process of doing this, we're showing it to visitors. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the visitors are all caught up in the excitement, and then somebody gets to let it go. Mm-hmm. Who's the oldest person here who's willing to admit to their age? Who's the youngest person or the oldest person who's under 21? Mm-hmm. Whose birthday is it?
Yeah. And the excitement when it's them to get to be the one that you place the bird in their hand and the bird flies off. It's so palpable.
Yeah, it's nice.
It is really nice. So I remember when I was there, and correct me if I'm wrong, but to determine how much fat is on the bird, you would lay them in the palm of your hand and then blow on their belly. And that was a very new experience for me to see that. So how can you tell through that
how much fat they have?
Yeah.
Well, unlike us, which is really good for us, the bird's skin is, especially these tiny birds, is really thin, and you can see right through it. Most of what you see when you're blowing on their belly, when really blowing on their chest, is muscle. And that's another thing you see when you're looking at, when you're blowing, is whether or not the muscle is rounded. And you're saying, yeah, that looks like a really healthy bird. A bird that is migrating, who has no fat, and the muscle is, shape is changing, you're saying to yourself, this bird can't find food, and they're using muscle as their energy source. The fat is yellow, and it tends to enter an area, build up in an area that we call the fricular hollow, and we just are eyeballing it as to whether or not there's a little in the bottom, or if it's half full or if it's full, or if there's fat just all over everywhere, which is, a bird is like, oh, wait, you can go. Start fine. You're set.
You're ready.
That's right. And there are some years where the birds, as a group or specific species, simply one bird after another, just anecdotally, you're seeing lack of fat and you're worried. Mm-hmm. Other years where birds look really good.
Yeah.
And overall, when you get to the end of the year and you have some time to actually look at that data, or when it goes off to the bird banding lab, which is the home for all of this data that is collected, they have the ability to analyze some of that and begin to look at what's happening to birds.
Yeah. And so what are some contributing factors to why some years there might be more fat or there is not enough that is very worrisome?
Yeah, it's absolutely related to food.
Yeah.
When food is available. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we just finished spring banding, you met us at spring banding this spring, birds coming back from the tropics, they make the decision to leave their wintering grounds when their hormones start to rage. It's absolutely hormone driven. So it's not like the weather's changing, or I mean, there's the same amount of daylight pretty much every day if you're down in Costa Rica. And that makes their decision about moving. They are being told by their body to get back to their breeding grounds. Let's say we have a late spring. And when we have a late spring, plants and insects go through their change process together. As plants start to develop, insects will come out of whatever their winter behavior is. But they're sort of happening in tandem. Well, if we have a late spring and the plants are late and the insects are late, and you got these migrating warblers who absolutely have to have insects coming back from Central America, and they get to someplace like Texas, and it's like, whoa, my food's not here.
Yeah.
Now what do I do? And what do they do? Do they wait? Do they move? If they move without food, they are going to get to a certain point where they simply can't keep on going because they don't have the energy, or their health is compromised and their ability to breed will decline. If they don't keep on moving and they wait until their food becomes available, then they may get to their breeding grounds late. And a lot of these birds breed in Canada and the Northwest Territories in Canada, which is really far north. And the breeding season is very lush, very powerful, lots of insects, but it's also very short. And if they're a week late, and 2 weeks late, forget it, you know, they're a week late even, it's a lot of time that bird is losing in that very fertile, lush area where they want to raise their young, and they may not be able to finish raising their young. So for us, looking at the fat on the bird gives us an indication of whether or not that whole process is on schedule and working properly for the birds. Mm-hmm. Are they finding the food they need?
I remember you saying at the bird banding as well, you know, where we band are these migratory hotspots often, but it is just one point on their thousands of mile journey. And so having all these stops, the need for energy to keep moving, the need for spaces to rest and to feed is why it's so important that everyone everywhere helps to contribute to the well-being of the ecosystem and habitats.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When I came back from Costa Rica, I was volunteering for Denver Audubon. Denver Audubon introduced me to the Bird Conservancy, where I sort of stayed. It was like I got there. I went out to the banding station at Bar with the Kingrees birding class, and I say I never left. But that partnership is an illustration of the kind of relationships you have to have, the kind of partnerships you have to have if you are going to conserve birds. It is not one organization, one place doing things. The relationships have to be with multiple organizations covering vast areas, all cooperating and collaborating, or you're not going to save birds.
Collaboration is absolutely necessary.
And here we are today.
And here we are.
Bird Conservancy and Denver Audubon.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so I loved learning that, how long your relationship has been with the Denver Audubon. And what is it like to have a relationship with a space such as the Denver Audubon Kingery Nature Center at Chatfield and to return there every year?
It's terrific. I mean, it's wonderful. Erling was out with several groups. Erling Kingery was out with several groups this spring, and that was just absolutely delightful to see her and to share stories. And
it's a beautiful thing. So that day that I was there, we banded quite a few different species of birds, and they had very different responses often. The catbirds were very feisty. And then the yellow warblers just had this, you know, sweet look on their face as if they had not a bother in the world. And, you know, this is just where I'm meant to be. So are there any particular species of birds that just really bring you joy or give you a good laugh in their personalities?
I don't know that there's any species that I have a very hard time. It's like, which of your children is your favorite?
True. Just, that's fair.
It doesn't really work for me, but I have some particular love for really common species because when you pull a bird out of the bag and it's new and it's unusual and about, you know, 3/4 of the crowd have never seen it, may never have seen the bird at all, it's really, really exciting. And then you pull out a starling and it's like, but they are, their personality plus birds.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just, and you know, they can make every sound of every other bird almost. Oftentimes out, we don't hear them so much at Chatfield, but we hear them out at Bar and people will say, wow, that's a so-and-so. And we're like, no, it's a starling, you know? And they're very alert and they're looking around and they're nipping at your finger. And I mean, they're just, they're full of personality. I like them even though they're considered an invasive species. And we have flickers all over everywhere in town. They're big and you... They look like they'd be scary, and they look like they'd use that beak to just peck the heck out of you, but they're not. They're gentle giants. They have personality, and when they get really stressed, they have this funny thing that they do with their heads where they shake it, and you think, oh, dear me, what's happening? And then they stop, and they look, and they're like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
We had one day where we caught 5 flickers all at the same time.
Whoa.
And you talk about walking back with your 3 little bags.
Yeah.
Well, the volunteers came back, one flicker in a bag, the other one in their hand, I ran out of big bags. Somebody else came up with two and is like, what do you mean you ran out of bags? I didn't have anything to put the first one in when this one was. Anyway, so we banded all five of them, got everybody together for a photo. And the birds were like, okay, I'm ready. And the humans were like, this is so wonderful. It's yeah. Best day of my life. So I like the really common birds that we have in our yard. That I like the house sparrows that are yelling at my dog when he comes out of the house and gets in their way.
Mm-hmm. I love the chickadee chatter too. I had a fledgling flicker in my front yard a few weeks ago, and that was so special. He was sitting there on the stones, and you could see him. He'd get like really sleepy and call out to his parents, and they'd call back.
Yeah,
they were there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love that you bring up the starlings, because I would say about 80% of podcast guests I've had now have brought up their love for starlings. Yeah, it's a common thread, and I love them, and they're beautiful, and
yeah, they are.
They're gorgeous, and
they're in the hand. You can see really see the iridescence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're lovely birds.
They're lovely. And have you noticed this, that they seem to hang out a lot on traffic lights or near intersections?
I have not noticed, darling. Okay. That, but there, there's a lot of thoughts about why, not just starling, but certainly swallows.
Okay.
Are in intersections, and it has to do with the generation of insects being pushed up probably by cars.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I've been wondering that.
It's a food source.
Yeah. Yeah. But I love the contrast of, you know, being in a busy street, and we live in such a busy world when we're in a city at an intersection and there's the noise of the cars, and it can be disorienting. And then above it all, I can hear the song of a bird.
Well, there are some birds that tolerate those environments, mm-hmm. and it's really nice to have those.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to also remember that the vast majority of birds can't, don't.
Absolutely.
One of the very best years for birds was the COVID year,
mm-hmm. yeah.
because there was less traffic and less noise, and downtowns were darker.
Yeah.
People were going to bed earlier or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, they were not out and about, and people were paying more attention in the backyard, so they were probably keeping their feeders full. I mean, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that that's a good thing. We're not going back to that, but
absolutely,
it is an indication of the kinds of things that help to make our environment better for birds.
Absolutely. It's something we can learn from. I remember seeing that about the birds, about whale song being more prevalent again because there weren't as many ships in the ocean. And how can we more steward a life of coexistence with the environment? And on that note, what are simple actions people can take to support the environment?
I figured you were going to ask me that question. So, and there's, you know, a few years back, somebody put together the 10 tips, 10 things you could do to mm-hmm. simple things you could do. So I decided to make sure I didn't miss any of them if I tried to list all of them. And I went online last night, and I now know that there's about, I don't know, 25 million organizations that have each posted their 10 tips. So my first recommendation is to say, go online. Because mm-hmm. and look at the lists and pick out what is important to you. And I looked at the lists. You know, I mean, a lot of things we all know about. You can put out food. You can get rid of your lawns. All those kinds of things are important. But the one that stuck out for me last night was the share your passion.
Mm-hmm.
And which is, of course, here we are sharing our passion. But at a time, and I think we are at a time right now where people, even close friends, are not getting along very well. There's all these issues that are driving us to be angry and uptight and worried. And all that is happening. And with this topic, you don't have to demand that people do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But sharing what you do and how much you care about birds, sharing, I, I love the people who come out to the banding station 1 year and the next year they come back and bring friends. Mm-hmm. Grandparents bringing their grandkids, adult children bringing their elderly parents, friends bringing other friends. You're not advocating for anything. You're sharing something that mm-hmm. matters to you. Mm-hmm. You know, buy a friend that you always wonder what to give them for Christmas. Buy them a bird feeder.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, there are just so many ways that without, we can just share what, and I believe most of the people who are going to listen to this podcast are going to be people who are already pretty far into the we care about birds world. This is going to be a crowd that's already convinced themselves that they care about birds. But there are a lot of ways we can help to encourage others without being pushy, mm-hmm. without them rolling their eyes and saying, oh God, it's her and her birds again. Mm-hmm. That can make a change. And once somebody gets passionate about it, they go to those simple things that you can do, some of which are more simple than others, mm-hmm. some of which make people crazy because they don't want to keep their cats inside, although I believe that you should. Mm-hmm.
yes.
But, so anyway, that's my tip for today. If you care mm-hmm. about birds already, think about the things that you can do without being pushy to introduce other people to birds.
Yeah.
And then go read the list yourself and pick out the things that you yeah. want to do.
So perfectly said. And coming from that open-hearted, loving space and passionate space, it inspires more passion. It inspires more love, you know. And so I think when we can allow ourselves to express that, it inspires others to do the same in their own unique way.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And finding what we are passionate about, what feels good to us, is also more sustainable and motivating. If we're acting from that place that feels loving, we'll keep it up. You know, exactly. We'll keep doing it. And then our impact has a longevity and a lasting effect to it.
Hopefully.
Yeah, true. But all we can do is hope sometimes.
Yeah.
So with that, what does give you hope?
What gives me hope is that there are lots and lots of people who care about birds.
Yeah.
And to whom birds matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the starting point. Birds are not something that is highly controversial in terms of should we have them, do we want mm-hmm. them. I mean, a lot of people don't think about it and don't really care, at least in part because they've never been introduced to them. But there are a lot of people who do care. And they come from all walks of life and all ages, and it's not aimed at one group or another group.
Yeah.
It's much more of a bringing people together thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we just need to keep it foremost in people's minds.
Yeah. It's been really spectacular seeing this community of the Denver Audubon grow in person and also on social media. And to see how many people are, you know, saying things like, wow, birds brought me so much joy today. Seeing this bird made me happy today.
Yeah.
And the community that birds inherently have the capacity to build is, I agree with you, giving me so much hope too. It is thousands of people
yeah.
that are like, yes, birds. And it's beautiful and it's hopeful. And I see it in my personal life that as well, that bridge they create. And when I got this job and I've had birds come up in my work throughout my last decade of working years. And every time I do, I start getting more messages from my grandparents. I saw a wild turkey today with a photo. Or my best friend telling me about the hummingbird she saw. My mom telling me kingfisher stories. And so there is just this thread they weave, and people are so excited to talk and share about them. And I just find it to be so wonderful. We talked about pursuing our passions, and you have done that with birds. And in the beginning, we talked about how this was a huge pivot in your life for you. and you said everything changed. There's no going back from there. What insight do you have for people at any age about making a big pivot in their life to pursue their passions?
What's this Nike saying?
Just do it. Yes.
I think we should modify the way we think about our life goals. We still have this thing that, you know, kids are growing up, they get into high school, and everybody starts to ask them what they're going to be when they grow up. And there's this pressure to make a decision when you start college about mm-hmm. what, you know, picking a major and what you want to do. And yet there was an article, I don't know, last couple of days in the Washington Post or New York Times, one of them, about kids, you know, they went into college and said, oh, I'm going to be a programmer. And they're mm-hmm. coming out of school and the programming jobs are drying up. I mean, mm-hmm. not only are people changing what they want to do, but they're finding out not in 10 years that their job has disappeared, but before they even get to the point where they're in their job. So we should think about careers and professions as something that as you grow and you get older and your ideas about what you want out of the next 10 or 15 years change, that you have the ability to have some mobility in terms of changing to something else. Yeah. Or, you know, all sorts of people are losing their jobs. Where do you go and what do you do next? Yeah. Especially, and I think it's especially hard for people who have programmed into their minds that whatever they're doing mm-hmm. is what they're going to do for that 40 or 50 year time period when you're working.
Yeah.
And so whatever that first step is, isn't the last step.
Yeah.
And as you change and as you look around and meet other people and do other things, you may want to do something else. It can be a good thing to have two or three professions and not get caught up in one thing at one point in time. I mean, I made a huge pivot, but I didn't. I think of it as a huge pivot now, and I ended up in a very different place than I was. But I didn't do it overnight. I went back to school. I was working the whole time. I mean, I was lucky. I had a job where I was able to work from home and take assignments or not take assignments. So, I mean, I was very, very fortunate in being able to do it. But lots of other people have as well. So we ought to not see graduation from high school or graduation from college and getting a job as the end. It's the sort of beginning of a lifelong thing, and you can change whenever you want to.
And I agree. I mean, I relate to that from being in high school to going to college, feeling the pressure, feeling the urgency, feeling this external, again, to use the same word, pressure to choose one thing. And it yeah. always felt so trapping to me because there are so many things I love and there are so many ways I want to grow and pursue growth. And one of the core truths of life is change. And if we don't allow the space for people to change and to explore those varied passions, it strips the life force out of people. And we need alive people, especially now. So I saw a statistic that throughout your time banding, you've banded about 30,000 birds. Wow. I was mind blown. Like I'm like holding my armchair, jaw dropped. Just like, I can't even fathom. That's amazing.
Well, it adds up. You know, it's about 1,000 birds a year between the two stations and some years more. And it's been 2,000. Let's go with 2,000. It's that 25 years.
Yeah.
Somewhere it gets to about 30,000.
Yeah, somewhere it does. So within that.
It's still a passion. It hasn't changed.
What do you think is the most poignant lesson that birds have taught you throughout the last 25 years?
We humans think we're so smart.
Mm-hmm.
We have all these things that we've done, and we control all of the other creatures and mm-hmm. stuff in the world, and we've, you know, done away with a lot of them. But these birds, the ones I work with, these little birds, they are 4 or 5 months old. They are out of the nest. They are flying from, let's say it's a yellow warbler who hatched this spring at Chatfield. Mm-hmm. And that yellow warbler is going to take off without his parents and go down someplace in Central America, is going to find essentially the same place that his ancestors have gone every winter. And then that bird is going to fly back in the spring. Assuming he doesn't get eaten by a hawk or whatever, mm-hmm. but he's going to fly back in the spring, and he's going to end up at Chatfield, probably, where he will raise young and then do this process year after year. He's going to find food in each of those places. He's going to find food in between. Now, not all of them survive, but not all of us survive. And we can call it instinct. We can call it something besides intellect. But these guys are amazing. They are absolutely amazing, you know, and they aren't building colleges in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And they aren't doing AI and, you know, all this other stuff. But I'm just in awe of these birds. Every time I release one, and it's gone. And I'm watching it fly, and I'm thinking, I wish I could fly. They can stay warm when it gets cold. They have all of these instincts that tell them what to do to stay warm, or to raise their young, or to, you know, I mean, it transfers over to other animals as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a dog now, 3 years old, who knows that it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and it's time for his second walk. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's sitting right there. I mean, he's mm-hmm. been off napping for 3 hours, but he's mm-hmm. sitting right there. How does he know that? How does he know the difference between when I put on my sandals and when I put on my tennis shoes?
Yeah.
I have a lot more respect for other creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. Me too. They're truly the light of my life. they are. Since I was a kid, I see an animal and I think it's just the absolute best thing. And every single one, I have these squirrels that have moved in, you know, because they find it, they smell the seed. Sure. And so they'll find the scatterings. And so I was walking home from a walk the other day, and there's a tree in the front yard and a tree in the backyard, and the tree in the front yard kind of hangs over the pathway to my front door a little bit. And I'm walking up, and this squirrel comes to the edge of the branch, and he just stares right at me. And I was like, oh, the food isn't out yet, huh? And he looks at me, and I was like, meet me in the back. And I kid you not, I walk through the house. It's a little galley setup. I see him crawling along the fence, and there he is in the backyard. They are so smart and so wise, and they have so many forms of communication. Communication that absolutely, when we speak, and things that we cannot even fathom. And I think that they can just invite us into so many different ways of being. And if we embrace that, we can really change the world, change the earth.
Well, there's lots of studies that show that getting outside, mm-hmm. even for a short period of time, makes us healthier and happier, yeah. and more able to, you know, get through the next 3 hours of whatever it is that we've got to accomplish that day. And when you add squirrels and birds and mm-hmm. rabbits, and we were at a bar doing a tune-up training for new volunteers and old volunteers, mm-hmm. and there was this baby rabbit that was around, and it's like we were ignoring everything else because we were watching this baby rabbit go mm-hmm. around and pick at the bird seeds and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And I thought, we are grown humans, just absolutely delighted by this baby rabbit. And that's like wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the joy of being alive when I get to watch a baby rabbit eat seed. Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Well, thank you.
And for doing all that you do. And how can people support the bird banding effort, or how can they follow along with Bird Conservancy of the Rockies, get involved?
Absolutely. Well, 1 week from today, the banding station opens out at Bar Lake.
Amazing.
And I invite anybody who has not come out to visit and or has visited before and wants to come again to go on to our website and find the bird banding registration point and sign up, come out. It's for the princely sum of $7 a person, which all goes to help Bird Conservancy continue to conserve birds in their habitat. You can spend an hour with us in a small group learning more about birds and seeing them up close in the hand. And we'll be doing it for 9 weeks. And then anything else you want to do to support Bird Conservancy and or Audubon, there are lots of opportunities to volunteer and to donate and to just share the message of birds and the importance of birds with your friends and family.
Absolutely. We're here to share in the passion with all of you. Any last things on your head or your heart that you feel needs to be shared?
I think we've covered all my...
Perfect.
I don't think I have anything else I should share this morning.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Meredith. This has been a joy.
Well, thank you. And we will continue to work together. I had lunch to review Chatfield, spring Chatfield, and talk about fall and next spring with Kristen this week. So I've spent a lot of time with Audubon this week, and it's been great.
Wonderful. Well, I can't wait to see you out bird banding and see some more birds in the hand. It's truly life-changing. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone tuning in wherever and whenever you're tuning in from. Until next time. And there you have it. This has been The Curious Bird. Thank you to our guests, our editor, Joe Escanos, and to you, our audience, for your time, curiosity, and openness. If you'd like to see these conversations continue, we would greatly appreciate your consideration in donating to our nonprofit, which you can do at the link in the episode information. Your generosity helps keep the conversations and our work flowing. To the bird lovers, the bird curious, the heart-centered, and any and every listener, until next time, when we meet again to build bridges, heal from separation, remember interconnectedness, and hear from the real inspired voices that are creating change in service to coexistence.